Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now, you're welcome back. So we're remembering Niki Lauda, who passed away at the age of 70, world champion three times, 75, 77, then with McLaren in 1984. Delighted to say we have a guest on who always gets a great reaction. John Watson, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Joe.
I presume you've been talking about your old friend quite a bit today.
With great sadness, yes. I mean, there's been massive amount of interest. Such a sad day that Niki's no longer going to be present. His family, of course, directly his two young children, but the three other boys that he has, plus close family, friends. I mean, it's just all I can say. A very, very sad day, and to lose a friend, as apart from a competitor and a teammate, at this point, and only 70 years old, only turned 70 on the 22nd of February this year, still a young man.
So we had a lung transplant recently. One of the things I've been reading is that this goes back to the 76 crash in Germany, that his lungs were badly damaged in that crash. There were toxic gases inhaled, that maybe that was the genesis of these problems.
I don't know, truthfully. I think that a medic could give you a better heads up on that. For sure, he did suffer damage to his lungs, but I don't know what level of damage was sustained through his life, or whether the recovery was virtually total. For sure, what he inhaled in 76, the toxic fumes from the burning fiberglass and the resins in the fiberglass at the point were life-threatening. But then post that period, through the time that we were racing together in 1978 and then 82 and 83, at that point there was no indication that he was carrying a lung weakness, for example.
So, we'll talk about his driving career in just a moment, but it's worth stating as well that even post his driving career, he had a very successful life in many ways, and he founded his own airline, thanks very much, and he was a familiar face around the circuit. Obviously, he was involved with the Mercedes team, and he was involved in bringing Hamilton there to replace Schumacher at the end of 2012, and in 2013, I think he became a 10% shareholder in Mercedes. So, and he was doing his punditry as well. So, this guy was generally a figure still very much involved in the sport and a part of the modern scene.
Absolutely. I think the biggest deal he did was actually take Michael O'Leary's money when he sold him Lauda Motion, I think, the airline that recently was acquired by Ryanair. And anybody that can sell something to Michael O'Leary has got to be a star in my book.
As for the driver that he was, and we'll talk about his personality in a moment, I read something today which said that his driving was characterised by elegant stylishness, all economy of effort and fluidity, matched by his belief that it was simply the driver's job to work as hard as possible on the technical aspects of the car and to make it work for him and let it do the work. It was not spectacular, but it was certainly effective. What kind of driver was Lauda?
I think that's a very adequate summary, because what Niki believed, and that's how he ran his whole, I suppose, motorsport philosophy, is to make the car do the work. I mean, it's much easier to win a Grand Prix in a car that requires the minimum amount of effort from the driver than one that requires a huge amount. So your energy levels are so much less, and your ability to maintain a high level of performance are therefore much easier to do. And one of Niki's great successes was understanding what he needed in a race car and directing the technical team. Remember, we were talking about a period in the 70s and early 80s where the kind of downforce levels were a fraction of what we're talking about in a contemporary Formula One car. And his influence, therefore, in the team, especially in the 70s, where cars were basically springs, roll bars, and shock absorbers, that was the period when Niki had so much knowledge and ability to develop a car around his particular requirements.
And what made him great?
He was an intelligent, focused, very, very competitive man who was clear-thinking, was honest. He was honest about himself and to himself, and honest to his team. Not a lot of racing drivers will concede if they've made a mistake. They'll try and bandage it up in some kind of little fantasy. But Niki was straight and honest, and that's important to a team, because if they're getting misled by someone who thinks I can bluff my way out of a mistake that I've made and blame the car. If Niki made a mistake, he was the first to stand up and say, sorry guys, I made a mistake. He wouldn't have put it in those terms, but a bit blunter. And he would have said, look, I'm sorry, my mistake, move on.
He was your teammate for a time?
Two different occasions. In 1978, he joined Brabham when I was there. he not only joined Brabham, he brought his personal sponsor along with him, and that personal sponsor then became the sponsor of the Brabham team. So it was a slightly loaded circumstance, one might say, in his favour, but that was how motor racing at that time was.
Mm. And what kind of teammate was he? Like, we're talking about alpha males here. Generally, you guys don't seem to be overly generous to each other when it comes to the business of winning. Was he tough to be alongside?
He was certainly single-minded and focused on his own efforts. But on a personal level and on a human level, I liked the guy a lot. Mm. I liked being with him. I liked his company. We would, you know, in a time again in the 70s, you could go out for a supper or dinner or whatever you choose to call it. With your team, Bernie Ecclestone would come out. We would all go out to dinner. We would laugh. We would have fun. It's something today that I think at the level of professional sport is across the board, certainly Formula One, you would very rarely see that interaction between teammates and team principals going out and laughing.
Mm.
You know, it's simple. It's not rocket science. But that's, I think, why that period in motorsport was a very good period. And I don't particularly like this style of Formula One we have now, where everything is so controlled by marketing people. A driver cannot speak to a journalist today unless it's almost a prearranged appointment. And everything is monitored down to the last syllable. I mean, we're losing personalities and characters. And the people that should be the personalities and characters are the drivers. We're losing that.
There's a clip I want to play. He did an interview recently with Graeme Bensinger over in the States, and it nods to what you're talking about, his frankness, his intelligence, his level of self-awareness as well. So we'll pick it up here. He goes on to talk about his obsession at the time and the toll it took in his marriage, but he starts off by talking about the perils of fame, and he talks about even just trying to build relationships with other people. Have a listen.
The problem is when you get known in the world, a lot of people bother you. They want to be your friend because, and this and that, and this is...
Everybody needs something.
Correct. And therefore, I protected myself against these constant attacks. Somebody says, I'm your friend, and can I do this, and can I do that, or I want an autograph, or whatever. And to stop all this, in a way, I protected myself and said, where are the real friends? A real friend is a 24-hour guy who can talk about any kind of problems you have. And I tell you, honestly, I would not know one where I would do that because I protected myself.
Your ex-wife once said during your racing career, you were the biggest in the world. What do you think of that?
No, she was completely right. She said egocentric too. Because in my times where it was very dangerous to drive, I had to put myself into a position that I 100% concentrate on my job. If I do a mistake, I kill myself. And I cannot be disturbed by anything of my 100% concentration, more or less to stay alive over the race weekend. That means you had to block everything out and then do the job. And this ended up in a way that she hated racing. She hated that I've been a racing driver because her reaction was logic, crazy. And I want a husband to be at home and stay alive. So, and therefore, she said all that, and from her point of view, she was right. But on the other hand, she said to me, after the accident, she was looking at me all the time, and I know what she was thinking. I hope he's gonna stop now. I hope he's gonna stop now. And I did not, because I wanted to prove to myself that I could overcome all these problems I had. And I wanted to see, after a terrible accident like this, can I be back on top again? So I understand her arguments, I understand her say, that I was an a**. She for sure thought about it sometimes. But in the end, she was a fantastic woman in these difficult situations for her to still support me 100%.
It's a brilliant clip. The ability to rationally analyze himself so openly and honestly is very admirable.
Absolutely, and I mean, Nicky was discussing things that a racing driver has to do, and I mean, he married Marlena, who's a fantastic lady. She comes from a totally different kind of background. She's more creative, artistic, a much more live and let live kind of personality. obviously she saw something in Nicky which she fell in love with. But of course then, particularly when they had the accident, one can understand why she would have been disappointed, maybe, that he didn't retire. But you have to understand what is it that drives people, Nicky and others amongst us, to want to continue, and in a period when it was very, very dangerous. And it's because it's something that we like doing. I don't know why, if you want to put us in a psychiatrist's chair and analyze us and go deep into our psyche to find out, why do we want to put ourselves into a situation where there is imminent danger all around? At any moment, any one of us at any given time could have lost our lives. Why would you want to do that? Well, I tell you what, it's a fantastic experience and feeling of achievement when you succeed. It's a very selfish profession because you're self-satisfying yourself all the time, but you're putting your loved ones through purgatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you feel guilty about doing that?
I didn't feel guilty because I was doing something which I dreamt about as a child that I wanted to do. And I was fulfilling that dream. But of course, you know, I had family back in Belfast in Northern Ireland. And this is a time when the degree of television broadcast was very restricted. You'd maybe get a highlights package if you got that. Well, you might get something on the news. And when I was first in 1974, went to Argentina and Brazil, you had to book a phone line in your hotel at midnight to get a call through to Belfast. I mean, it was arcane. So, yes, it is a selfish sport. But is it right to deny an individual the right to fulfill themselves in a way that being a Grand Prix driver, being a racing driver, can fulfill that person? They're prepared to take the risk, especially in this period we were talking about, where the risks were much greater. But I think that at the time we were taking the risks, we all believed that we had the safest cars, we had the best track safety, we had the best medical support and backup, that we were racing in the best possible context of any form of motorsport in the world. So we thought that we were being protected. But of course, with hindsight, we know that it was a much, much more dangerous period.
Yeah.
And accidents would often lead to serious injury, fatalities on occasions. And when you look at what we're doing today, the advance in car safety, the technology and the design of racing cars, is a million miles away from where they were in Nicky's case when he crashed at Nürburgring.
Yeah.
Likewise, racetracks. I mean, we're going to Monaco this weekend. It's an arcane racetrack. But it's the jewel of the crown of the Grand Prix season. It's a low-speed circuit, but still, these cars will be doing over 180 miles an hour on the streets of the Principality. But then think forward maybe to Silverstone. Silverstone was the first Grand Prix circuit that held a world championship event in 1950. The fundamental layout of the circuit is still there, but the circuit that is now used for the Grand Prix is a much-changed layout.
Yeah,
it's got wide-open spaces. But I tell you one thing, it's got some of the best and quickest corners of any racetrack in the world. And racing drivers love that challenge. They don't like the stop-go, 30 mile an hour, turn left, turn right, kind of contemporary racetrack that sadly we're seeing more of.
The reason everybody around the world is talking about Lauda today is because of the crash at the Nürburgring in 1976 and his, frankly, incredible return to the sport. The Nürburgring was deadly dangerous, as we know, and as well the way the emergency services were kind of stretched across the 14 miles, it meant that if you were in a serious crash, then there was a bit of a wait until people got to you, which was another aspect of the whole situation. As I think we touched on this before, as I understand it or as I remember it, John, you arrived on the scene after Lauda's crash. Did you help him out of the car?
No, I didn't. Nicky, the other drivers, Arturo Mazzario, Guy Edwards, Brett Lunger, they'd all, as Nicky came back on the racetrack, they got caught up in the tail end of his accident. So I think it was actually Arturo Mazzario who straddled the cockpit and helped get Nicky out of the cockpit. I mean, a very courageous thing that those three drivers did. I turned up just at the point when he's being removed from the cockpit. So we moved him up the racetrack away from what was still the smouldering remains of the Ferrari. I suggested that maybe lay down, relax if you can, I kneeled down and let him rest his head on my thighs. And I was able to look down into his face, and I was able to see how extensive the burning that he had suffered was. And it was very extensive and very ugly. And you know, he said to me, "What's my face look like? What's my face look like?" And all I could say is, "Look, you're fine, don't worry. The medicals are on their way now. You'll be on your way to hospital. Everything's going to be good." And once he had left the racetrack, we then jumped back into our race cars, drove back to the pits. The race, the grid was reformed, and we went motor racing again at the Nürburgring.
Wow. It's extraordinary. It must have been like the most horrific scene looking down at him.
I mean, it's not the prettiest picture, and I'll not go into graphic detail because it wasn't pretty. I mean, without question, Nicky was severely burned.
Yeah.
What do you call it? Stage 3 burns. And it was, you know, I don't know what he felt, because your body goes into a kind of sort of numbness. You've got these natural protections against severe pains. But obviously, he would have suffered greatly when that began to wear off, and would have suffered in hospital, and he would have suffered discomfort and pain all the way through up until the point when he returned to Monza for the Italian Grand Prix.
Just 40 days later, and
yeah.
The BBC had a piece today on their website where they talked about that return, where he finished fourth at the Italian Grand Prix, because he was very much involved in the title race with James Hunt. And they say on the BBC, by the end of that race, 40 days later at the Italian Grand Prix, his unhealed wounds had soaked his fireproof balaclava in blood. When he tried to remove the balaclava, he found it was stuck to his bandages. He had to resort to ripping it off in one go. It was one of the bravest acts in the history of sport. And Lauda himself, in his autobiography, I know he has talked about, you know, like I just got on with it and I got back in. He did write in his autobiography, "To Hell and Back," "I said then and later that I had conquered my fear quickly and cleanly. That was a lie, but it would have been foolish to play into the hands of my rivals by confirming my weakness. At Monza, I was rigid with fear." And then he said later on, "Lying in bed ruminating about the ring would have finished me." That was the reason he decided to get back in the car. I can only imagine the post-traumatic stress he was probably suffering, because at Japan, the finale of that season, when again he was still in the title race, there was torrential rain. And he withdrew after a couple of laps, saying it was too dangerous. I mean, I'm not surprised. And that line at Monza, "I was rigid with fear," I honestly can't believe he got back into a car again. Did you ever talk to him about it?
Well, I mean, I was part of that Grand Prix, and I was aware of the return to the cockpit, and would have been aware of the emotions that you can feel when you're getting back into a car after such a big accident. But one thing that I know that Nicky benefited from, and that was the association with a great Austrian physio and trainer called Willy Dungel. And before Nicky returned to Monza, Willy Dungel devised a number of little tests to check whether Nicky would have the capacity to physically as well as mentally get back into a racing car. And he passed all those tests.
Mm.
So he was pretty well prepared to the point of physically getting into the car. But no doubt there was a sense of trepidation.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't prevent those negative thoughts flooding into your consciousness. But he got into the car.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The physical act of getting into the car is the first thing. Then you sit in the car and you get strapped into the car. And then you pull your visor down, you drive out of the pit lane onto the racetrack. And for sure you're thinking, am I doing the right thing? But it doesn't take really that long for all those negativities to change into positives, because the racing car and you should be one and the same thing. Nicky's car would have been set up the way he likes it. It would have immediately given him a positive sense of feedback. That there's nothing that was frightening him in the car.
Mm.
But understandably, it took a session or so for him to go through that mental barrier to get to the point that when he got in it a second time, it wasn't as difficult.
Mm.
And the third time was becoming easier. So by the time that he got into the car for the Grand Prix, which is a totally different discipline to doing practice and qualifying, he would have felt much, much different to the moment he stepped into the car the very first time. Now, if you go forward to the end of the season in Japan, that race day, we woke up, it was pouring. It was monsoon rain, and it didn't stop raining all day. But finally, around about 4 o'clock, it kind of began to break up. But the track, and there's a lake the size of Loch Ness at the end of the straits. I know, I went through the thing and I just aquaplaned off and spun off.
Right. So it wasn't Lauda wasn't being paranoid, it was genuinely torrential.
No, no, it was awful. I promise you, it was terrible.
Yeah.
But one of the difficulties that Nicky suffered at this point was he had scarring on one of his tear ducts. He had tissue scarring on one of the tear ducts. So he couldn't control the flow of water. And because it was not only a very wet day, it was a cold day. So combining the cold and the wet meant that his eye was watering and he couldn't control the flow of water. So I think that was one element that made him uncomfortable. Visibility was negligible, certainly in the opening laps on the main straight. It was a long main straight, and we're still doing 170, 180 miles an hour in those days down that straight. So he was clearly concerned about the lack of visibility. And thirdly, I think he took a punt in that when he decided to stop after two laps, and he was totally honest about his reasons why, the fact was James Hunt had to win or come no lower than third in the Grand Prix to secure the world championship.
Right.
And frankly, you wouldn't have got odds on anybody finishing the race.
Yeah.
The conditions were so poor. So Nicky threw the dice. He stopped, watched the race from the pit lane, and he watched James Hunt lift the crown. Nicky had won this world championship virtually by the time he got to Nürburgring. All he had to do was coast into the final few races, and he was going to be a two-time world champion in 76. He won it in 77. Goodness knows, he could have won four, maybe more Grand Prix world championships.
Yeah. Incidentally, and briefly, because the clock is against us, perpetuated by that recent movie, it's one of the great myths that Lauda and James Hunt hated each other. They didn't.
No. I mean, look, there's two aspects. One is the personal aspect. The two guys, completely opposites in one respect. On the racetrack, they were there to do the best for their individual self as well as for their team. There was no quarter given.
Yeah.
But they fought cleanly on the racetrack. There was none of this, what I think I don't like to see, weaving around or, you know, late dives or blocking. They raced cleanly. And, I mean, for example, James Hunt dominated the Dutch Grand Prix in 1975. James was a difficult driver to pass. But, you know, they raced cleanly, and that's what I feel was very important. Away from the racetrack, they had an affinity with one another. I don't know why, but sometimes opposite attract. And they just got on very well, and they enjoyed one another's humour and one another's company. And, you know, they would be frequently seen in the pit lane. I don't want to think what they were talking about. You wouldn't have to be Einstein to work it out.
No, I wouldn't think so. And actually, this is, I don't know if he ever talked about it. It's probably a kind of personal question in some respects that only he could answer. Like, as we're talking here, we're also kind of broadcasting on various social channels. So there's a visual aspect and we're showing pictures of Lauda. Like, you wouldn't have to be a vain person to mourn the loss of your appearance. Did he struggle with that at all? It didn't seem like he did.
No, and he took this very pragmatic, typically Nicky approach. And he said, you know, I'll not do his accent because it's not appropriate now. But you know, people like me before the accident, why should my face make any difference to whether they like me or not?
Yeah.
And, you know, most people who suffer that disfigurement, one of the things they wanted to do is to get surgery to calm it down, to probably try and get back some of the features that they may have lost. And Nicky certainly lost, I think it was his right ear, a portion of his right ear. And, of course, the scalp was severely burned and it lost a great deal of what hair he had. So he wasn't vain in that sense. All he wanted was the mechanics of his face to work. He did have surgery at a later time, a year or so later, to repair or to try to recover the function of the tear duct in one of his eyes. And that was done by a plastic surgeon in Brazil. And that was about the extent of it.
Right, wow.
And funnily enough, he used that disfigurement to his advantage because many, many people, largely women, would look at him and their hearts would just bleed. But remember, Nicky was an exceptionally talented and highly intelligent man.
Yeah.
You look into some people's eyes and you can tell that's a very bright, intelligent person.
Yeah.
And he was one of those people. And he knew how to use his eyes to get what he wanted.
Yeah. Listen, it's a brilliant tribute. There's lots of people enjoying hearing you again. We must bring you on in the next month or two and have a chat about your own career, John. But for the time being, thanks very much.
That's too boring. Let's stick to things that are more topical.
I suspect we'll find some interesting bits and bobs. Thanks a million.
All right, Joe.
John Watson there on Niki Lauda.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.